Today is the first Sunday in Lent. But you won't find the word Lent mentioned in your Bible dictionary. There was no such thing in biblical times. There is some evidence that early Christians fasted 40 hours between Good Friday and Easter. But the custom of spending 40 days in prayer and self-denial did not emerge until much later. Barbara Brown Taylor's version of the events is worth quoting at length, I think. This is how she tells the story. When the world did not end, as Jesus himself said it would, his followers stopped expecting so much from God or from themselves. They hung a wooden cross on the wall and settled back into their more or less comfortable routines, remembering their once passionate devotion to God, the way they remembered the other enthusiasms of their youth. Oh, to be young again, and to believe everything is possible. Little by little, Christians became devoted to their comforts instead, and they decided there was no contradiction between being comfortable and being Christian. And before long, it was very hard to pick them out from the population at large. They no longer distinguished themselves by their bold love for one another. They blended in. They avoided extremes. They decided to be nice instead of holy. And God moaned out loud. Hearing that, someone suggested it was time to call Christians back to their senses. And the Bible offered some clues about how to do that. Israel spent 40 years in the wilderness learning to trust the Lord. Elijah spent 40 days there before hearing the still small voice of God on the same mountain, where Moses spent 40 days listening to God give the law. There was also the story about Jesus' own 40 days in the wilderness, a period of preparation between his baptism and his ministry, during which he was sorely tested by the devil. It was hard. It was awful. It was necessary, if only for the story. Those of us who believe it have proof that it is humanly possible to remain loyal to God. So the church announced the season of Lent from the old English word Lenten, meaning spring. Not only a reference to the season before Easter, but also an invitation to a springtime of the soul. 40 days to cleanse the system and open the eyes to what remains when all comfort is gone. 40 days to remember what it is like to live by the grace of God alone and not by what we can supply ourselves. Of course, we don't need this story of Jesus' temptation in the wilderness to know that it is hard to live by grace alone. We know only too well that life is often a struggle, not only against temptation, but just to keep on top of things. We know only too well that it can be hard to believe, hard to trust in God. And Lent only seems to make things worse. All this time spent searching our souls, it can be a dangerous thing. Some would say that Christ is the answer. The answer to all our longings, the answer to all our problems. Just have faith. Simply trust in Jesus, and that dark cloud hanging over your head will quickly drift away, and life will be better again. But others aren't so sure, because life never seems quite so simple, even with faith. The skeptic argues that Jesus had the chance to fix things, to make things right, to make things easy for us, and it seems like he just passed it up. So now we are left to struggle, not only with temptation, but with life. So how can Jesus be the answer when so many questions still remain? This is the question of the Grand Inquisitor. As some of you may know, the Grand Inquisitor is a literary invention of the dubious Ivan, a character in the great Russian novel, The Brothers Karamazov. Ivan imagines a scene set in Spain during the most dreadful period of the Inquisition, when bonfires glowed throughout the land as heretics were being burned at the stake, and the Grand Inquisitor presides over it all. Ivan imagines that Jesus is returning to Spain in that time into this furnace of religious persecution to walk among the people again, as he had done some 15 centuries before. The crowds immediately recognize him, surrounding him in a mass of flesh, pushing and jostling each other to be close to him. Voices cry out for healing. The scene is out of control, shouts, sobbing, and then suddenly the Grand Inquisitor appears. He has seen it all, and with a flick of the wrist, he orders the guards to arrest Jesus. The crowd disperses as quickly as it had gathered, and Jesus is taken away again. What follows is a fascinating scene, as the Grand Inquisitor, that great defender of the church, rebukes Jesus for not finishing what he started, for promising people freedom and leaving so much for the church to figure out on its own. "We don't want your help now," the Grand Inquisitor says. "We have corrected your great deed. We have given the people what they really want. Not freedom, but someone to be in control, to give obedience to. Someone to give them the bread they need, even if it does come from stones." The Grand Inquisitor continues. Remember the first question the devil had? Remember what he said? Its sense was this: "You, the Son of God, want to go into the world and are going there with empty hands, with a kind of promise of freedom which people in their simplicity are unable even to comprehend. For nothing has ever been more unendurable to humanity than freedom. Look, you see those stones in that naked, burning, hot wilderness? Turn them into bread, and humanity will go trotting after you like a flock, grateful and obedient, though ever fearful that you may take away your hand and that your loaves may cease to come their way. But you rejected the offer," the Grand Inquisitor says in disgust. "For what kind of freedom is it, you reasoned, if obedience is purchased with loaves?" It's easy to dismiss the Grand Inquisitor, this figment of a character's imagination, as the personification of the misdirected zeal that drove the Inquisition, a symbol of the brutal hypocrisy within the church at the time. But the Grand Inquisitor also gives voice to some of the very questions that people of honest faith have always had about Jesus and the facing of temptation. Maybe Christ is the answer after all, but maybe we need to figure out first what the question really is. The gospel begins by revealing to us that Christ is indeed the answer, but not in the sense of taking care of all of our troubles, but in directing us to the place where the right battles are to be fought. Jesus is the answer to the struggles of life in the sense that he reveals to us where we should be struggling to lead us closer to God. In a wonderful little book on temptation, Diogenes Alley, one of my professors from seminary, reminds us that it was the Spirit, after all, who took Jesus to the place where he was alone, who drove him into the wilderness to be exposed to the devil. It was the Spirit who took the initiative. Dr. Allen describes this as one of the great laws that is in operation when we deal with God. We are not in charge of the circumstances. We do not set the terms or the conditions by which we are to find God. We are dealing with a mystery. And we also discover that one of the conditions that God sets for us without any say on our part is that we are exposed to evil. Whatever its ultimate source may be, whatever our part might be, we are surrounded by a world that is less than what God intends. We find ourselves, if we are honest with ourselves, in the wilderness a good bit of the time. We take evil and sin seriously. We don't whitewash our world or walk around with those rose-colored glasses. We know that not all is well in the world. We are often in the wilderness. But Alan reminds us that it is there, that it's in the wilderness, that we discover the gateway to finding God. For it is only in facing up to sin and evil, only in acknowledging it and renouncing it, that we can find the gateway to God. We don't find it by pretending all is well with the world. We find it as we discover that not all is well, but that God is with us, nonetheless. The next thing that we notice is that temptation does not usually come when we are ready for it. It does not come when we are the strongest, when we are at our best. It comes when we are weak, just as it came to Jesus when he was hungry, having fasted for 40 days. For whatever reason, God seems to have decided that our situation would be one in which we would have to find him, to learn to trust him and love him while we are exposed to the reality of evil and the temptation of otherwise good things. God did not want to purchase our love with loaves of bread or enslave us by some miracle. God hungers for us to have a faith and a love that is free. So, just exactly what is the question to which Christ is the answer? Is Jesus merely a good example to follow as we walk in the same footsteps and experience the same kind of temptations? Does Jesus resist temptation simply to show us that it can be done? I don't think so. Jesus' temptation is much more than a morality play. It describes for us the beginning of a journey which leads ultimately to the cross. Jesus, who pioneered for us a way to the Father through the wilderness of temptation, ends up on a cross. There he faced his most final and decisive trial. We are not called to endure the agony of a literal cross. Jesus faced that trial in all of its horror for our sake, in our place. We are called instead to be witnesses of the cross. The renunciations that we make as we seek to follow Jesus make us more realistic about ourselves. We know in our very bones how strong and powerful evil is, how alluring it can be. Temptation, in this way, prepares us to be witnesses to what Jesus endured on the cross. By our suffering, we can begin to understand his. By the evil we have resisted, we can imagine, to a degree, what it would be to endure its full effect on the cross. We can imagine his temptation to lose faith in his Father when he was bearing the full weight of the world's sin in his body on the cross. We can recognize the greatness of Christ, who, unlike us, endured the full force of it. And we understand why we cannot, and that we don't have to. We can, in this way, be witnesses to the cross as a victory. For Christ, by his refusal to be overwhelmed by the devil, won a victory over evil itself. Even apart from the resurrection, the cross is a sort of triumph, not a defeat. Those who have resisted evil and walked as far as the cross can perceive its true Lord. For in the cross we see most fully the mysterious wisdom of God, as our opportunity to find our true life has been made possible by Jesus' death, a death on our behalf. The power of evil over us leads us to seek fullness in life, in material goods, in power or prestige. But we are called to die to such a life, to walk with Jesus and to be free of it. This is how we are able to find the true life, which comes from full communion with God. So Christ is the answer, I would agree. For in Christ we find a way into the wilderness and back again. Our journey into the wilderness teaches us about our own dependence on God and the mysteries of God's ways. And only then, only when we have passed through the gateway of temptation, are we ready to receive the gift of God's tremendous love, which otherwise seems rather empty. I do not know what brought you to church this morning. I don't know what temptations you are dealing with. But I want you to know that Christ, who knew what it was like to go toe-to-toe with every kind of temptation, will stand with you, will stand beside you, and that his community, the church, will stand with you too. Thanks be to God for the promise of new life. Thanks be to God for the power to be whole again. Thanks be to God.